All the leaves are brown and the sky is gray.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Amy Mason Doane, author of the novel The California Dreamers from Graydon House. Amy is the best-selling author of three previous novels, Lady Sunshine, The Summer List, and Summer Hours. Before turning to fiction, she worked as a reporter and editor for The Oregonian, The San Francisco Chronicle, Wired, Forbes, and other publications. Amy has an MA in journalism from Stanford University and a BA in English from UC Berkeley, and she currently lives here in Portland. Writer Julie Clark says of The California Dreamers, "Magical and atmospheric, Amy Mason Doane's latest perfectly captures the California surf culture of the 1980s, a special time of sun and salt air and freedom. Equal parts mystery and family drama, The California Dreamers is, at its core, a love letter to an era that no longer exists. I promise you will devour this enchanting story." Please join us for our conversation with Amy Mason Doane, which is already in progress. Amy, I so enjoyed the book, which brought me back to my high school days in Los Angeles. We were city kids, so headed to the Santa Monica Pier almost every summer to body surf. Not exactly the traditional surf culture, but it was cheap and easy for us. My girlfriend, however, and this was first and second year of college, she lived down in Southern California, but in Corona del Mar, which was definitely board surfing world. So I got a taste of it through her and, of course, through listening to the Beach Boys, Jan and Dean. That was her culture, her life, a little different from me. But you grew up in Danville, California, so that's inland.
Very inland.
About 20 miles east of Oakland, about 35 miles from the Pacific Ocean. I'm guessing you were not a surfer.
I was not. I was actually born in Merced, California. Talk about inland.
Even more inland
and very far from the world of this book. Very inland, very suburban, very rooted, and very traditional. So again, unlike anything the family in Dreamers is like. But I read and I watched movies. And I loved Gidget. I did. Loved it. Will defend it forever. I love Sandra Dee and everything about it. So I was fascinated by surfing. And I had a lot of friends who did surf and would go to Santa Cruz. And it was a trek from Danville when I was a teenager to Santa Cruz to surfing. But I think I was always interested, even though my world was so different. It was intriguing to me. And I think the book kind of captures that as much as the insider perspective. It kind of touches on this idea of the California dream, right?
Yes.
Surfing is a dream, and surfing is something that outsiders kind of wonder about and worship and are curious about, or maybe enraged by.
Was even true when I was a kid. Living in the Los Angeles city proper.
Right.
And again, the Beach Boys and all that and summer fun. And then, and of course, Gidget movies. And there was a whole bunch of beach bikini movies.
Beach bikini movies.
With surfers.
And then what did they represent, right? To some people, maybe older people, it was like youth, and it was, but for some, this was the dream, right?
And
I think it was for me too. I think there was that here's little nerdy Amy reading Jane Eyre, you know, in Danville inside, not even in the sun. You know, I wasn't one of those teenagers in the 80s who was out slathering myself with, you know, Bandit de Soleil or baby oil. I was inside reading, but I I've always been interested in that world, that outside world. And then as I got older, I did live in Newport Beach for a while. So not far from Corona Del Mar.
And that's right. And that's a true
very briefly.
Culture,
and
too.
I wrote for the Orange County Register.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to get into your journalism career, but I wanted to start a little earlier than that.
Sure. Go way back.
So after Danville, you went to college in the Bay Area.
Yes.
Two really good schools there. Mm-hmm. Your undergrad degree at UC Berkeley.
Yeah.
And then an MA in journalism from Stanford.
Right.
Why journalism?
The honest answer is that I was an English major, as some others of us in this room were.
Yes, I was.
And I had this vague idea when I was studying English that I would get into publishing somehow, but I missed the deadline for the Radcliffe Publishing Institute by a week, so I couldn't do that. This is how much I planned back then. All I knew is that I wanted to read, okay, but nobody was going to pay me to do that in California. I couldn't find any jobs. And so I went back to school, and then I found that I loved reporting, and I was very good at it, very good at putting people at ease and getting them to talk, and had a great journalism career for 2 decades.
Yeah, part of that was The Oregonian,
right?
San Francisco Chronicle. Wired, Forbes. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a paper in Newport also?
Yeah, the Orange County Register is actually
in Santa Ana. Oh, that's a big paper, yes.
Yeah, in Orange County, and that was fascinating because I was actually in the opinion department. I was the only kind of left-leaning person in what was then a libertarian newspaper, libertarian-owned.
Orange County had that reputation there.
Kind of
the Republican stronghold
of
Southern California.
But great people there doing great work, you know, a little bit of everything. And I still love newspapers, and I still have that curiosity and love talking to people and feel really comfortable asking questions. And the other thing about a journalism background is that we finish things. So it's really good when you make the leap to writing fiction.
You have to. You have a deadline.
That doesn't mean we're perfect at it and that we don't procrastinate with the best of them. But I was a journalist for 20 years, had always wanted to write a novel. I'm sure you've heard this many times talking to authors.
In fact, I interviewed two other Portland-based authors this year. Both came to fiction writing from a career in journalism. Laura Stanfill.
Of course, yeah.
At Forest Avenue Press, and Nancy Townsley.
Yep.
And in addition to mentioning what you did about having to finish things and being disciplined as a writer, what Nancy said was curiosity is the first requirement of journalism. Mm. And my assumption is that you can say the same thing for fiction writing.
Definitely. And I think you're good with dialogue, too. That's my experience. I think that journalists tend to have a good ear for dialogue and honesty. One thing I learned as a journalist is that everyone lies. You know, I was a business journalist for a really long time, which didn't quite suit my interests, but I learned a lot. I was working for a huge business magazine.
Was that in New York?
Yeah, that was for a little while. You always got trained in New York. I worked for Forbes. I'll just say it. It was one of the big magazines and still is and does great work, but I was miserable. I was put to work doing something called the Rich List right away, which is
Like the Fortune 500?
Yep, or the Forbes 400. They do billionaires and, you know, and we would check, the Cub reporters would check all these wealth figures. So here I am, Amy, goes from reading Jane Eyre to working for this business magazine writing about really, really wealthy people. And I felt very, very disconnected from where I'd started out in journalism. And I think that is what made me finally pivot to fiction.
Right. And actually, there was something you read that led to this particular book, this specific book.
Yep.
Also, in one of your interviews, and I don't know the timeline when this came in, but you mentioned the influence of Judy Blume.
Oh.
Getting you to start writing fiction. She's, of course, a very popular author of children's novels and YA novels. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. It's not just influence. I would not have any books completed, let alone published, if I hadn't had this wonderful Judy Blume connection. So my book group that I was in just as a reader in Portland was doing a Margaret and Margaritas night. Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret.
That's probably her best known book.
And they made a great movie out of it with Rachel McAdams. But we just decided to do it as kind of a a breath of fresh air. I think we'd done like something pretty intense right before, like the Wind Up Bird Chronicles or something. So we're like, we're going
to
do
it. It's hard to figure out a cocktail that goes
so
with
this
that.
Was like,
Margarita's
perfect. Margaritas and Margaret, and a throwback. We all loved it. All women of the same age who, you know, the 80s, who had, you know, Judy saved us, this generation. We loved her honesty. And so my friend and I, who were in this book club, just started looking at Judy's website for fun, and we saw that she was running a contest because she had a movie coming out, an adaptation of Tiger Eyes, which was actually her first book adaptation before Margaret. And we were joking around. Someone could enter, say why they loved Judy Blume, and the winner got to fly to LA and meet Judy. And so I did it. I entered. My friend Virginia and I were joking around. I'm like, I'll bring you with me if I win. Ha, ha, ha. Well, I won. I won. And I got to go to LA.
Was it an essay you had to write?
Yeah,
why I want to meet Judy Blume?
A couple paragraphs about, you know, and that was easy because I genuinely have been obsessed with her forever and still have all my copies of her books that I saved for my daughter and still reread them with pleasure. They're all torn and, you know, battered and held together with duct tape and binder clips. But I won this thing and it got to meet her, saw the movie, and got to talk to her. And I think it was the first time I admitted to anybody, you know, I hadn't even told my family that I was really in the middle of writing a book. I didn't have a lot. I maybe had 20,000 words of something, didn't know if it was any good, but I told Judy. And she's this very petite person, and I'm pretty tall. And I just remember she held both of my hands, and she said, you know, if I can do it, you can do it. And boy, it was just like electricity going through those little petite, delicate hands into mine. And I came home, and I was fired up, and I did it. You know, I finished. And my first thought was, I'm going to just finish a book. That's the initial goal. If I could just finish a novel.
Which one was that?
Well, it was not. This is a little bit of trivia. It was not the first one published. It's the novel that became Summer Hours, which was my second novel to be published. But it did get me an agent. And it was strong, this book that I wrote. I got me a fancy, amazing New York agent who's still my agent. But it was kind of had an uneasy, it didn't fit neatly into a category. It was about 20-year-olds. So people kind of didn't know if it was about kids or adults. I put it in a drawer. And the first novel that I got published was
The Summer List.
And the second novel was actually a reworked Summer Hours with an adult plot braided in so that it was a past present timeline. Still very much had the soul of that book that I wrote after meeting Judy, but it needed a little adult update. So she's everything. I mean, I wouldn't have finished.
What a great person to do that, to be so encouraging.
Huh? Oh, yeah. She's amazing. And, you know, so much of writing is a mental game, and writers deal with fear, as so many people in the arts do. It's fear that holds us back, fear of not being good, fear of not holding up to this standard that we have inside.
Of not getting readers.
Not getting readers.
After all that work.
All that work. And it's a real fear, and it's a legitimate fear, because writers spend years and years on things, maybe more in some cases, and that we're rearranging these pieces of our hearts for the public to pick over, or worse, to ignore, right? That's the reality of it. And it's scary.
You tend to take that personally, I
think. Oh, a little bit. And
even though it shouldn't.
You shouldn't, but yeah. You know, writers tend to be sensitive. You know, we're empaths and we do care. I have thicker skin now, 4 books in, and now I'm writing my 5th novel, but you still care. And, you know, in these days, you can get tagged in a negative review on Twitter or Instagram. You know, that didn't used to happen. But it's the same vulnerability.
Yeah, it just takes one crank.
Right. And it's not easy, but you're putting yourself out there. This is such an old story, you know, and that there's just new technology now. There's always ways to be hurt as a writer, and there are always excuses to not write. But to answer more simply, you know, Judy got me over that fear. It was like, this was a sign, and I did it, and I'm so grateful.
Was this after you were in New York?
Yes, much later.
Because I want to take you back to New York
for a second, when
you were working for Forbes.
Sure.
There was something that you, an event there that inspired this novel, The California Dreamers.
Yep.
And it was an article you read about the Paskowitz family.
Exactly.
And they had a surf school in California. The father, Doc Paskowitz, I think his real name is Dorian. was a real doctor, a physician who dropped out from society in a way, not just Stanford, and raised a very large family, living in a van off the grid and spending a lot of time surfing. Of course, he was an excellent surfer. The family included Doc and his wife, Juliet, and nine children, boys and one girl, all homeschooled.
Yep.
You were working in New York for Forbes, and you said, I think this is in the book, in appendix.
Yeah, there's an essay in the back, exactly.
Yeah, you said you were at a low point, and you wrote, "My own spirit had shrunk." So what attracted you to the article, and how did that spark the novel and prevent your own spirit from shrinking any further?
It's that one person or story coming into your life at just the right moment, just like the Judy thing. I was on my lunch hour. I had a kind of a rental in Murray Hill in New York, and I actually spent my days next to a collection of Fabergé eggs writing about these rich people. And I'm like, what am I doing? You know, this is not what I wanted to do. I missed newspapers, but I also just felt like I didn't belong here.
And it's not the Pentagon Papers or Woodward and Bernstein.
This wasn't the Washington Post that I had dreamed of, you know, back in the day.
The current one's not either.
Exactly. Catherine Graham, rest in peace. Anyway, but I read this article about their surf school, Dorian and a couple of the kids. And it reminded me of a book I'd read by Doc when I was at Stanford.
Oh, was that Surfing and Health?
Yes, Surfing and Health.
Because we'll talk about the documentary for the family, which is how I got familiar
with them. Exactly. And he had always fascinated me because I read his book. It was very much almost a self-published book, or you would call it vanity published maybe, but really interesting and really gave you an insight into him and his family and his beliefs. Just a little window, a sliver of a window.
Yeah, surfing, nutrition.
Surfing, nutrition was
what
big.
He calls vitality, just vitality. Living life to the fullest.
Yes, yeah, his ethos, right? And the reason that he had this family of nine kids and you know, traveled around the world and rejected all that success on paper. You know, I was in my way, I guess, successful on paper, but I was miserable. And so it struck me at the right moment. I wanted to be back on the West Coast, and I knew that I couldn't continue just pursuing a resume. It wasn't for me anymore.
And certainly not writing about rich people.
Right. It was, and again, I was in the English major and maybe hadn't done a great amount of planning when I was younger, but I was a different person now. I was older, and I went back, and it inspired me to leave journalism and get into fiction. And so it was the first idea for a book that I had. Again, everything I did was kind of topsy-turvy. The first book I wrote was the second book published. My first idea was actually this one, which was my fourth book published. I had this idea to write about the only girl in that van.
Nava.
And again, my book is not their life exactly. It was inspired.
Oh no, we'll
by
talk about some of the you mentioned liberties that you took.
Yeah, definitely.
But differences
it's
for fictional
not a retelling,
reasons.
But it was absolutely inspired by them and their story of living off the grid, chasing waves, up and down the West Coast, not going to school, inspired me to look into other families who were off the grid and surfing and this whole world I didn't really know about growing up.
Was the movie out then?
Surfwise was out.
Oh, okay.
Later, yes.
Because so that's how I got to know them.
And everyone watch it.
Wonderful documentary.
So good,
yes. It
right?
came out in 2007,
yes.
But it's easily found on streaming services now, often for free.
Often for free. But yeah, it's so good. And listen, watch it immediately if you haven't watched it. Yeah, I loved it. But again, it shows some of the tension in the family, not just the dream.
Oh,
right?
Does it?
Does it ever? They're very candid.
I've watched it twice in the last 2 weeks.
Everything, the diet. And so you get the beauty, but they're so beautifully honest about the downsides of the lifestyle.
Because they're
right?
interviewing the kids as
yes,
adults.
Exactly.
There were, again, there were nine kids, only one girl,
right.
all living in an extremely small camper
yep,
van.
No privacy.
With a very autocratic
yep,
father
yep.
and somewhat submissive mother.
Somewhat submissive.
Who did a lot. And
yeah.
And it showed their relationships. And that must have made the story even more appealing
right.
to you as a novel, to
yep.
novelize it, to
yep.
fictionalize it.
So the more I started digging, I rewatched Surfwise. And when I sat down to write this book again, I had written three other books in the interim. But when I really sat down and decided I was capable of writing this book, which had more points of view and, you know, a tricky braided timeline, I started looking at that, the patriarchal aspect of the life and that dream. And that goes way back to the 50s and that surf culture. There's a brilliant...
Oh, you could see it in Gidget.
You can see it in Gidget, sure.
Yeah.
There's a series in Life magazine from 1950, and I think it's Loomis Dean was the photographer. And you can see it in the pictures. You can see that the women are cutting people's hair and cooking in these camps, right? Not always, certainly, but... So that's interesting. And I had a little epigraph on a post-it note as I was writing this book, and it was, who gets to define freedom for me?
Because freedom for the wife, mom in the book, but Juliet mm-hmm. Paskowitz mm-hmm. and Nava, uh-huh. the only daughter in the family, was not quite the same
no.
as the freedom for
no.
the men in the group.
Yeah,
they were cooking and sewing
yep,
and all that.
Doing the child raising, and there were yeah. a lot of kids. So... And in this book, too, Ronan is my character, and we see mostly through her point of view. She's taking care of her little brother, Dill. I've made the family, you know, half the size. It's less than half the size. We've just got four children in
and
this
one. And that's really to make it less confusing to the
A little
to
less confusing. And also, yeah, I really did want to get into the points of view of the brothers. But life is certainly not perfect for the other children either. They later, and just like the real family that inspired the book, they had questions like, what if I want to be a doctor myself? Well, kind of tricky if you got homeschooled. Not impossible, but...
Oh, that was in the documentary.
Yes,
yeah, the Paskowitz
exactly.
Kids,
the one kid who really... I forget which brother it was, but he
yeah,
really
Yeah, one
wanted
of them
to be a
said
doctor.
That it wasn't possible. It
yeah.
would be another 10, 15
yeah.
years before
and
he
was
able to get into med school or
right,
get a degree.
Right, and was pretty heartbroken.
It was too, he had a lot of catching up to
yep.
do by never having gone to a formal school.
Yeah, so I just felt like it would make a wonderful story and that... Obviously, there's a lot to think about as well as to feel, which is what you want when you're going to set out to write a book for a couple years and hopefully produce something that people connect with. So it's that duality of the dream and the reality of it. And in my book, the family gets together, the siblings really, the four siblings come together because the father has died. And they're coming to terms with that, those choices that mainly he
they're
made.
They're adults now.
They're adults, sorry.
Yeah,
yes.
So this is about 15 years later.
Exactly. So we know that the daughter, Ronan, kind of ran away from the lifestyle at, I feel like she was 17, but we don't know why.
Ended
she
up working on a lavender
yes,
farm in Oregon, yeah. Getting married to the guy who owns the farm
exactly.
and then having a kid.
Yeah, two kids.
two kids.
And very, just the exact opposite, right? Like she's literally rooted. As are the lavender plants, like this rooted existence in an old farmhouse hasn't left and hasn't, we learn, even gone near the ocean for reasons both practical and kind of mystical or mysterious at first. We don't know why she hasn't gone back. She hasn't surfed, hasn't even gone swimming, but she's turned her back on that life. And then she's summoned back by her brother.
For the funeral.
For the funeral, basically, the paddle out, which is what a real surfer family would do, where they pour the ashes in and surround it on their boards. She's obviously very torn on whether she will go back and confront this, whatever feelings this might dredge up about the choices he made, the choices she made, too. But she goes. She has to go where there's no books, obviously.
That's pretty much how it starts.
That's always how it starts.
It's interesting from the documentary that Nava had a similar experience.
Right.
She left the family
right.
As an adult, and she's living, at least when the movie was made, when yeah. she was interviewed, in a suburban conclave in Encino
yeah.
with two kids, a family. And not really pursuing surfing
right,
anymore.
Right. Do we
a
always,
very conventional lifestyle.
Yeah. And it's interesting to think, do we always flip-flop like that? We want something totally different from what our parents did. You know, I'm grateful for the middle class rooted existence I had with my own real life. You know, all my family was in finance, all of them, but not me. You know, I'm the English major. And then we flip back and forth, you know, and he had the best intentions, the father. Father in my book, Cap, has the best intentions, but did cause some harm. So, but they need to come to terms with this. And that's one thing that all of my novels seem to have in common. One reviewer, I think, said, I write about unfinished business.
Uh-huh.
And I never thought
about it. And family secrets.
And family secrets. And it's so true. I think that there are endless variations on that theme. It's emotionally rich. And that's what we're doing, you know, no matter how grown up we are, we're trying to process these events and these scars and these questions from our past. And do we have the guts to do it or not? Is that makes a good book? And well, hopefully. anyway, so that's it. They come back for this reunion / paddle out, but there's a lot more going on, obviously, a lot more under the surface.
Yeah, we won't give anything away, but I want to get to some of the liberties you took.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So between the real life Paskowitz family and Surfwise and that article on the surf camp, and the Merrick kids in the book, The California Dreamers. One we already talked about, and that's fewer kids.
We
go from 9 kids in the Paskowitz family to 4 in the Merricks. Another difference is the reclusive aspect.
Yes.
The Paskowitz family, at least from the documentary, they did interviews, they made TV appearances.
Yes.
They were considered, one surfer said, the most famous family in surfing.
Yeah.
I think Kelly Slater said that, who's the most famous surfer now. And Cap Merrick in the book, your father, a patriarchal figure, forbids all of that and guards against any intrusion by reporters, any publicity. He wants to stay under the radar. Doc Paskowitz was not quite as strict about that.
No, yeah, you wouldn't call him publicity shy. That was just my own. Again, as I say in the essay, this story kind of found its own break, to use a surfing term. It did. And they inspired the story, but I went in my own direction with it.
I was just interested in some of these differences for fictional purposes. I think it makes the book better.
Thank you.
Yeah, it makes it more interesting in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
Another one was in the movie, in the documentary, we see Doc later in life, Doc Paskowitz. He's living in, looks like a condo in Orange County.
Was it in Hawaii? I thought he was in Hawaii. No,
yeah, I'm not quite sure. Maybe it is Hawaii.
I think it was.
Anyway, it's a nice view of the ocean and a marina, and he exercises every day and doesn't wear clothing.
Right.
But apparently he was a very religious and observant Jew.
Yes.
And he's actually shown putting on a yarmulke and tefillin and praying in Hebrew. And his kids have biblical names. David, Israel, Moses, Adam, Abraham, Joshua, even Nava is a biblical name, Hebrew for, I think, beautiful or among other terms, meanings. And with your fictional family, the Merricks, religion rarely comes up. So that's an aspect you
is different. So the first aspect you mentioned, the privacy and that insular world that he's created, I think that just made it more intense for me.
It's necessary for your plot.
It's necessary for the plot. And I think so much of what we struggle with as humans is shame. And so I think that those rules that he has, Cap has a lot in the book, a lot of rules about who they interact with. And it's kind of a form of control for my main character, Ronan. And that's very personal for me growing up, with a father who was very much a product of his time and had rules and was the head of the household. And I think that I wanted my character to fight against that and to have these walls around her to beat against. And so the privacy thing aided that. The second point you make about the religion, I mean, if they have any religion, it's kind of his, right? It's almost, and a book group mentioned this. We had a great discussion.
That's
it's
true.
Almost like a cult.
Yeah.
Not quite, but a little bit there, because there's no outsiders and we're following his rules.
Exactly.
They do have his cereal that they eat and rules about, health. And as a woman, that intrigued me too. Like, what would it be like to be the only girl and have these rules about no body fat and all this, kind of fighting against nature. But again, all of this makes it sound as if everything was horrible. And that's not a very interesting novel to me, if everything is terrible. He made a lot of beautiful choices for them too. And the real family that inspired it and the characters, they do see that. Especially as they process what they went through, they're grateful for what he gave
them. Yeah, they're
them,
very conflicted.
Right? They're conflicted, absolutely.
Yeah, from just kind of excoriating Doc Paskowitz.
Right.
The oldest kid, David, has a song in there, which is almost like wishing for Doc's death.
Right, yeah.
I mean, it's. I was listening. I couldn't believe it that he'd want that exposed like that.
They
it's
were
almost
so
kind
candid.
Of a hidden thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, to at the end also, all the kids get together. There's a reunion for Thanksgiving.
Yep.
Even though they've been estranged for a while, several of them. And they're all very loving and they're all very thankful for their upbringing.
Right.
So what a conflict.
Conflict. And I just so respect the honesty. So something that just happened very recently is that the family reached out to me. And I had tried to reach them years ago through the Ed Asner Foundation, which is a great nonprofit they run, and didn't hear back and kind of felt like it wasn't fated to happen. And again, this is not a retelling. And I just kind of thought as a courtesy, I'd say, hey, I'm working on this. You know, you want to talk to me, whatever. But didn't hear from them and just had resigned myself to never meeting them. And then randomly on social media, Moses reached out to me because he had seen in a newspaper article that where I mentioned them, much as I am now. And they liked the book, they wanted me, and they're, you know,
oh, how exciting.
Like, love. I mean, and Nava liked it. I was especially worried about, you know, obviously, the only daughter. What does she think? Does she feel like this is, you know, a fair portrayal of some of what she went through since she was the inspiration? So
and she's the counterpart of the heroine
yeah,
of the
exactly.
book.
Exactly.
And protagonist.
Again, it's my own story, but it does mean something to me. And I am so excited to meet them and just say thank you for being so honest.
So you're in the process of planning that reunion?
Yeah,
that
I'm
meeting.
Hoping it'll happen soon. My I used to go to Southern California a lot because my daughter was in college there and she just transferred to New England. So I don't have that excuse, but I'm going to make it happen. And I was thinking about one thing you said about how the siblings, you know, one of them had that song, is that it was different for each of them, right? So they all had a different experience.
He seemed to be the most critical
the most
of his
angry,
father.
Maybe.
And he was the
most,
oldest, David.
Yeah.
And in a way, I could understand that because
right.
Doc had him doing things that seemed to go against his very principles
exactly.
and values.
Yeah. And so that's something I kind of try to plumb in this book, how outsiders can never really see a family clearly, but even inside the family, we're having different experiences. You know, my sister had a different upbringing than I did. Our siblings know us so well in most cases, but they didn't have the same parents that we did. It's always different. It's very personal. And I wanted to give each of them a fair shake in this book and kind of explore the story. And they each have their own resentments and loves. And at heart, I think it is a sibling story in many ways.
Now, getting back to Doc
and
some of these differences, despite his religious beliefs, Judaism, which I'm Jewish, so it's really a religion of vengeance. You know, I can totally understand.
Old Testament.
He's not exactly a man of peace, of nonviolence.
Right, right.
In Surfwise, the documentary, we learned that he beat his kids as punishment.
Yeah, yeah.
And the son, David, who had that song about him in the movie, he directed him to choke one of his brothers for breaking a family rule, which he was about to do until he kind of came to his senses.
Like, no.
Now, in the book, Cap is much kinder, with a more controlled temper. And you said about him, when I first started writing, he was almost villainous.
Mm.
And it was a little over the top, and I found that I grew a little fond of him. And I didn't want him to be some cartoon mustache-twirling villain like a Snidely Whiplash. How did Cap change from your first draft to the final version? Was he more villainous
early on? He was more villainous.
On?
He was never violent or physically abusive in that way.
So that's something you didn't take from the movie?
No, not at all. I mean, that in early versions of Dreamers, Cap had interesting ways of making money, and even in this version, he does have interesting ways of making money, but I think, you know, some of which cross lines, not to have too many spoilers, but early on...
No, it comes as a shock.
It comes as a shock, yeah, but early on, in the very first drafts of the book, he was really just terrible. Like, we really didn't see why they all didn't just try to run away or why Ronan waited till she was 17 to run away. And then, but I wanted to understand the lifestyle and really explore, again, the beauty of it and what they got in addition to what might have been taken from them or what they missed. So he became more sympathetic. They read, you know, they have this wall of books between the grown-ups and the kids in my version of the van. It's called the vanilla wall because the books are all kind of the cream-colored pages are facing the kids' side of the van, but it forms a wall. But they did have the library. Like, that kind of epitomizes Cap in my book, you know. But he was he encouraged them to read. They could read anything that, you know, was in the van.
Not just surfing and health.
Not just surfing and health. No. Not just something
an
like
that. An autographed copy.
Yeah. And he does, I think we learn more about Cap as the siblings do, along with them, as secrets are revealed and as they're processing things on this island where they go to spread his ashes. We learn more up until the very end about why he chose the lifestyle. And even if...
And also how he got together with Mama.
And how he found Mama. And, you know, how did you start living in a van, you know?
And so there's a big mystery aspect to the book I found.
Yes.
It keeps you reading.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I love secrets. All of my books are about secrets. And you've got to tease them out, you know, and reveal things at different times. And I really do want an emotionally satisfying experience for the reader. I think my books kind of straddle that literary commercial line in that way. To me, it's hard to define what makes commercial.
I guess
literary.
I don't even see the line.
I know. Well, it's so hard. It's so arbitrary. And what does it mean? If you like a book, you like it. But I do think that maybe I spend time thinking about the reader. Does that make it more commercial? I don't know. Nobody knows. But I think about the reader's experience, but I care about the prose and craft and layers and all that. So however you want to categorize the book, I did want it to be satisfying in that way, in a plot way. So the secrets are teased out, and I think the kids understand him, and hopefully the reader at least understands him. And I've had some heated discussions in book clubs
about
Cap, and is this abuse,
likable or abusive?
I should say he could be both, you know. But I should say I sit back while the group goes at it, and I enjoy what I created, you know? That's exactly the kinds of questions that I would love a book group or any reader to come away with. And
well, to me, that's just good fiction.
Right,
that's
hopefully.
That's just complex characters.
Yeah, something to think about. You know, would you make that choice for your kids? Would you be angry at your parents if they made these choices for you?
And you're leaving things for the reader to kind of decide in their heads rather than dictating to them
how to
feel towards a certain character.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like my job in this book was to present it in an engaging, honest way with characters who are real, people who sound real and think and feel the way humans do. And we can come away with it from this book thinking that Cap was a villain, maybe. Maybe he was a mustache-twirling villain. to me, he's not, but that's okay. Like, once you write a book, it's out there.
I didn't find him that way either.
Okay, good. Well, but maybe someone, you know, maybe they had a parent who was similar, and to them,
yeah, that's
you know,
where the reader's personality and their own background takes over.
So that's fair.
Now, the title is great, The California Dreamers. You did an interview for the last novel, and you were working on this book at the time, and you said you didn't have a working title.
Oh, wow.
When you started out, California Dreams just seems like the best choice, but were there other titles you were considering?
There were. I think at one point it was called The Golden Ones. And Dreamers is so much better. This was the title for most of this book's genesis and production.
Just not when you got interviewed.
Just not when I got interviewed. So my last book, Lady Sunshine, came out in 2021. And so that interview,
was probably around then.
Yeah. So I was probably, I was probably still The Golden Ones, or I was, maybe nobody liked that. You know, all of my other three books have had their titles changed by the publisher or by me, every single one.
Well, they're always Sunshine changed. And Summer.
Summer. Yeah. So we got the summer.
And they all came out in June, which I thought that can't be a coincidence.
This one is May. So yeah.
Okay, close enough.
Yeah. And I'm grateful for that. You know, I didn't set out to be the summer writer, you know, but I think you can, you know, you don't have to read my books in summer. I give you permission.
Actually, they're kind of just really nice to read when it's like today here in Portland.
Read it on a dreary day and it'll bring you to
gray,
the sunny,
wet, cold.
Yes, into the Channel Islands and Southern California and surfing. So, but I do love the fact that May is a great time for people to take a book on vacation with them. And I always say, it's a privilege to make it into your suitcase. So if you happen to read one of my books when you're on a trip or on your summer day off or whatever, that's an honor. You know, read it anytime.
Now, the title itself, so the California Dreamers obviously has those connotations.
Right.
So it has several meanings, but it's literally in the book a reference to a photo that Roe took of the family secretly.
Right.
And submitted to a student newspaper at UC San Diego, just out of kind of rebellion against Cap and his rules. And that blew up and made the family into surfer celebrities, kind of like the Paskowitzes.
Right.
It was used for products, the photo for beach towels, fridge magnets, a surf shop ad, which disturbs them.
Yep.
And in the book, the photo even makes the cover of Time magazine.
In a collage, right? I think, no. It actually makes it into a big, it kind of grows the photo. So the California Dreamers becomes the name of this photo back then, because this is the 80s when the photo was taken. You wouldn't have to know who this family was. Now you'd probably find out. But they, even though they...
They weren't identified in the paper because it was submitted anonymously.
And then it just kind of grows. Just as Roe's guilt and mixed feelings about this photo grow. It starts out kind of innocuous, and then it's on merchandise. It's everything that Cap hates, right? And it causes a lot of problems for the family, but it's also really important symbolically, you know, that Roe's allowed to have a voice and an eye, right? And so I think the photo was called The Golden Ones at first. So it was always the name of the photo.
Okay. Oh, then you changed
and
the photo.
And then I changed it to The California Dreamers. And it made a lot of sense because in the photo, and this is a question I get a lot, why isn't the cover of the book that photo? Because people think, you know, it should be a real photo. We made the decision, my publisher and I, not to make the cover of the book the photo.
That's a little contrived.
It's a little contrived.
Because you'd have to hire actors.
Right. And just, and if it's not who you what you thought it would look like, it ruins the whole book. So this, you can kind of imagine what that photo is like. But they're seen from the back, kind of lined up in the sun with their boards. And Ronan is kind of in the foreground, her head tilted. So you can kind of, if you can make out anyone, it's her. But you don't really know who they are. All you see is just, again, this dream, this fantasy of this perfect surf family.
Yeah, and they actually talk about why, I think at one point, Roe's brother, Dill, who's about 7 years younger, and she takes care of him, asked her, why do people care so much about that photograph?
Right.
Roe answers, I guess it makes them happy. It's California like it is in dreams.
Right.
It's freedom, sun. And then Dill says, pictures of happy families make people happy. So for me, the photo represents both the California dream, the sunshine and the surf, and the American dream.
Right.
Raising your family, having a house, being somewhat successful in terms of putting food on the table.
Right.
So it's kind of everything to every American, really.
Right. And as different as their life was from that American, you know, stereotype of the family on the cul-de-sac. And Ronan's obsessed with girls who live on cul-de-sacs, you know, because she just doesn't have that.
Like in Encino.
Like in Encino or Merced or Danville, you know, where some of us grew up. But it is, and they're kind of surprised. They the rest of the siblings are surprised when he says that about happy families, because they've forgotten that it is about a, it is a picture of a family. And they're a family as fractured as they are and as scattered as they are.
But not for this one moment, not frozen one. In time,
yeah.
Which is what photos do.
Right, exactly. Preserved in amber.
Now their favorite book, both Roe and Dylan, her younger brother, their favorite book is Island of the Blue Dolphins. For people who don't know, it's a much-loved children's novel by Scott O'Dell.
Yep.
Came out in the early 60s, I think, won a Newbery Medal. In 1961, was adapted into a film in 1964, which is how many people probably know it, remember it. And that happens to be another influence on the book, your book, along with the real-life Paskowitz family. And that tells the story of a girl named Karana, who, in real life, who was stranded alone, or based on a real story, stranded alone for years on an island off the California coast.
Yeah.
That must be one of your favorites, too, to have such an influence on the book.
I'm so glad you asked me that. Nobody has asked me about that.
Oh, man,
honestly,
it's name-checked in the book.
I know, and I anticipated so many questions about that, and I love the book, loved it when I was growing up, but dove into the real story, and it was very loosely based on a real woman called the Lone Woman, who was on one of the Channel Islands. The Channel Island that people know most is Catalina, I think. Yeah. But it's a chain of islands. Been.
But this is San Nicolas Island.
San Nicolas, yeah.
Which is not very well populated, if at all. I mean, she lived alone.
She lived alone. And then there are various stories that she was really a woman. She wasn't a girl. She grew up there. She did have a dog. She did have a hut that she lived in. 18 years alone. And she made herself shelter. She fished. She hunted. She dealt with the wild dogs on the island. There were a lot of dangers. She thrived, really. And she made herself clothing out of cormorant feather leaves. And then she was taken by missionaries, really, and brought to the mainland. She was Native American. Uh-huh. And she was brought to the Santa Barbara Mission. And that's where she's buried, actually. And I was there not too long ago to pay my respects. And they have a beautiful exhibit at the mission where you can see a replica of her hut and interviews and very few pictures. But I was so interested in that. She lived alone. How did she feel? She died very quickly after she was brought to the mainland. And we don't really know if she wanted to leave the island. But
you get the feeling she didn't.
She probably didn't. And we don't know it. So the book is very honest in a lot of ways in that she loves the island, Corona. But Dill and Roe, in my book, I think were fascinated because she's like a little replica of them, right, with this very small world. And Dill especially is a loner. He's a bit quirky. He's very happy just with nature and with Ronan. But he sees the appeal in that kind of life. So it's kind of the extreme version of Doc's choices, that isolation.
Except the lone woman of the San Nicolas Island was on her own. There was no man telling her what to do.
There was no man telling her. Exactly.
Unlike Dylan and Roe.
Exactly. And that's my point. And this is why I'm so glad you asked. So she was snatched away from the life that she chose. That was freedom to her, you know, because by most accounts, she jumped off the boat to stay on the island. In the book, I think she jumps off, in the book, The Island of the Blue Dolphins, she jumps off this boat at the last second to be with her brother, but that's probably not the case. She wanted to stay on that island. So she's this mythic creature for them, and they're fascinated by her.
And their copy of the book reminds me of what you just said about your Judy Blume books, held together with duct tape.
Yeah, yeah, their frayed, tattered copy is really precious to them. You know, they have very few possessions, but this is one of them that they cherish.
Six people in a surf van.
You can't
have too much stuff.
You got a Marie Kondo, a little like that. But of course, the things that are important to Doc tend to stay there. But they do have books. You know, they have this wall of books, and they're very well read. And books have to sort of be approved by CAP. But they're an intelligent, interested family, and they know a lot about history. And they're pretty self-aware, too. They know that their lives are very different from other lives.
Now, another influence on the book is, I think, the location. There's two timelines. There's like the mid-80s, where Roe is 15, 16, 17 years old. And then 15 years later in 2002, when they gather for Cap's funeral. And they pick a fictional island, Manzanita Island, which you say in the book is part of the Channel Islands. So that's off the coast of L.A., north to Santa Barbara. And it's described as located 20 miles from San Nicolas Island, where Corona lived, in Island of the Blue Dolphins. Yeah. Did you base Manzanita on one of the real islands? And I'm interested why you used a fictional one rather than one of the real. There's a lot of them.
There are a lot of them. And the interesting thing, sadly, is San Nicolas is now partially a naval base. But the wildlife is gorgeous, and a lot of people have maintained the islands, and you can visit all of them, even San Nicolas. It's fictional, but it's very much based on San Nicolas, and you can see San Nicolas from Manzanita. I wanted to be respectful of the lone woman and her experiences. I'm not a Native American woman, and I thought that was the right decision to just separate that and have this be a different story. So I also love the freedom, you know, in the island that I created. I was free to create the geography, you know, and have it be arid on one side and lush and green on the other. And
oh, right. A lot happens on that island in just a few days.
Yeah. And there's, you know, they love the wildlife in a lot of ways. You know, they're pretty happy there for those few days. And it's also where they would go to be alone and be away from what we would call the paparazzi, because this photo is blown up and they want to be they want some peace to do the paddle out. And, you know, there's elephant seals and foxes and cats. And
yeah, interesting. Ronan's birds. Name in Irish means seal.
Seal, little seal. Yeah, and her mother calls her little seal. Mama calls her little seal. Yeah, yeah. So they
That's
love...
probably how she looks in a wetsuit, huh?
Exactly, yeah. And she's fast. She's a good swimmer. And, you know, even though she's rusty near the end when she tries to surf again, she still got it. She's still a seal,
it right? comes back.
Yeah, unlike me, who's not a seal.
Now, in addition to Surfwise, which I watched originally, I think not long after it came out, yeah. but then recently twice. And I'm with you. I encourage everybody to find a version where they could stream or watch yeah. from the library.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
I watched another great documentary, a lot more recent. I think it came out about a year or so ago. It's called On the History of Surf Music.
Yes.
And it's called Sound of the Surf.
Yeah.
And they mentioned, as in the Paskowitz documentary, that there were very few surfers in the 50s. And it really only picked up with the music of the Beach Boys, the movie Gidget in the mm-hmm. early 60s. Mm-hmm. Also, there was things like surfboards were made out of fiberboard rather than slabs of redwood or whatever.
Right.
And they were lighter and cheaper and easier to manufacture. Now, the early surfers, so before Gidget, there's pre-Gidget and after Gidget, I guess, were considered dropouts from society,
yeah.
Beach bums, and Cap fits the mold, as yeah. Doc does in Surfwise. Cap calls those with regular jobs and houses citizens, not in a good sense.
No.
And also SSNs for yep. social security numbers,
yeah.
which the kids misconstrue as assassins.
Assassins, yeah. assassins of the soul, really.
So for them, yeah. it's not just a sport, but at least in the early days, a philosophy of life, a stance against conformity.
Yeah.
Now, in the book, Ro asks her mother, why don't those people like us? And her mother says, because they trudge and we glide.
Yeah, we glide. Yeah, and she's aware. Again, they hear the snickers on the beach sometimes, and people can be cruel, and kids on the beach to look at them and their shabby outfits and this lifestyle. But they're proud of it. And I think Ronan... When she explains to Dylan, her younger brother, why they live how they do, we see a lot of her trying to make sense of it herself, right? She's parroting her parents. She says to him, we glide, because, you know, she cups his little face in her hands, and just like her mother did to her. And she's
it's
like,
almost comforting rather yeah. than extremely accurate.
Right. It is because it makes it sound like there are no bumps in that road.
Uh-huh.
You know,
they're living better than everybody else
in the
country.
And again, some days they are. For many, many months they are, but it's far from perfect. And I think she says also at some point that it's a dream to those who look at their picture, and it is freedom of a sort, and she wouldn't have it any different. But what you see in a picture is not the reality for a family, and certainly for a young girl. So that tension between the reality and the dream, again, is the thing that propels the book, and hopefully is what gets resolved at the end. If I've done my work.
Now, Cap has a best friend, a fellow surfer named Bassett, or Bass for short.
Okay, yeah.
And he has a daughter, Charlie, who figures into the book, both in the early timeline in the mid-80s
yep.
and the current present day in the book of 2002. She's a few months older than Ro, also an expert surfer, just a natural. And Ro and Charlie are good friends, and there's a romantic bond between them. And we learned that before marrying a man in Oregon, Ro dated both men and women.
Yeah.
Now, in an interview you did, again, for Lady Sunshine... You did a lot.
I did. I know. You have to remind me. It feels like it was so long ago.
Okay, so I got this quote from one of them.
Okay, great.
There's joy in reconnecting with our girlhood selves and in revisiting our intense girlhood friendships and passions. And that's what I thought of. I mean, it was so innocent. It was just, you know, they're friends, and then they have this romantic attachment.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's ever really consummated. There's a kiss, but that's about
it.
Yeah,
it's not on the page. It's funny. Well, this.
Yeah, maybe it's implied.
It's implied. In fact, there is. They do have a lovely night together. But of all my four novels, I would say this has the least amount of, like, it's not a romance. There's definitely a love story that propels this subplot. But
yeah, it's not really a major plot
but
point.
It's really beautiful and, like you said, innocent. And, you know, Ro doesn't she's not affected by television, you know, and I grew up in the 80s, so she wouldn't know that this was considered taboo or strange or off, even though she is a mother and a father and has only seen this straight world and only sees it really on the beach. But no, those questions creep in later.
But she's not around a lot of girls.
She's not around a lot of girls. She's not around a lot of anybody. She's drawn to this person. She knows she's crazy about her. And Charlie is a friend that she's never had. She's had her brothers, but she's never really had a friend. But Charlie is kind of approved by Cap because he knows her father, Bass. And so...
Who seems to be his best friend in the world. His only friend, really.
I mean, he doesn't let a lot of people in, but Bass he trusts. So she... And also, she's sort of an honorary Vanner. She's not quite a citizen. She'd be sort of half Vanner, half citizen, because Charlie lives with her mother in Hawaii for half the year and then kind of travels with Bass for part of the year. So she's allowed into Rose World. And Charlie just opens up everything for her and starts to make her question, as happens in adolescence. What are these rules? And beyond just here's this amazing person and what does that mean for me? It, you know, what other worlds are out there for me? You know, these questions that she naturally would ask. Charlie's there to help her along and to help her break free a little bit.
Again, since she's not really exposed to television or newspaper or a lot of other people at all, it's just very natural. It's beautiful.
Right.
It's
just thank you.
Two people
I love
who,
Charlie.
Regardless of sex and gender, they love each other.
Yeah, yeah. And she, you know, she kind of wonders what would Cap think about this. But she just knows that this is an amazing person. And I think importantly, she first sees Charlie on the water far away surfing.
And is impressed.
Right. And that's everything. We don't really know much about Charlie, but that's something that would strike her as beautiful and intriguing. And every surf style is very different. Again, I'm not an amazing surfer or even a good surfer, but you know, it is, you can see someone from far away after a while and know who it is, even in a full wetsuit and booties and a hood. if you know them or you're intrigued by their style, it's a signature really. And so I thought that was cool, that spark from just seeing someone's surf style.
And that, of course, is such an important part of her life.
Absolutely. It's everything. And the book opens with surfing. It ends with surfing. But it's as much a book about family as it is surfing. Yet I wanted to obviously pay my respects to that world of surfers and hopefully did so.
Yeah. So in the book, there's one quote that just stood out for me that I love. Cap is talking to Ro about surfing. And he says, each wave is the ocean pushing us back to land, commanding us to go be mortal again. But every time we paddle back out, we're saying, not yet, please. Not just yet.
Yeah.
I love the line and how it describes what riding waves must feel like to be part of something eternal like the ocean, to be communing with the eternal.
Right. And I think that's
mortality,
what...
Mortality is not what you're thinking about at that moment.
Right, the land.
Even if it's a shark circle, you're fine, okay.
Yeah, that's true. That is an irony. But and again, I'm not this amazing surfer. I wanted to become sort of respectable.
Oh, so you took lessons?
Yeah, the respectable thing went out the window. I've also never lived in a van. I lived in a suburban house in Danville, but talked to enough surfers, did enough research, tried myself with my bumbling attempts to see that it is as much about, for many people, for many surfers, is as much about the peace of just being out there and waiting and scanning the horizon. You know, you're not facing the beach. You're facing the horizon most of the time. And that to me, maybe it's a metaphor. I don't know, but...
Surfers will always say
and
not just that, but they say it's actually healing.
It's healing.
They could feel like crap going out, and then they go out on the board and they catch a few waves and all that disappears.
And maybe you're only on your board surfing for a tiny percentage of the time that you're out there, but it's healing. And we see the very opening scene of the book is Cap and her father in a rare moment of togetherness and peace surfing, and they don't speak much, but it's solitary, but it's also communal, you know, and it's internal, but it's also very much driven by nature and unpredictable. So I just felt like I someday maybe I'll become someone who can surf beautifully. I don't think it's going to happen. But I have so much respect for surfers, going way back to people who brave the Oregon coast now, you know, as cold as it is.
Yes, we were just at Enesquin for Thanksgiving with my family.
Did you body surf?
I did not.
Did not. A little chilly?
There were actually a few surfers there by Haystack Rock, by the Pelican Pub out in Pacific City.
Oh, I know, right.
Of course, all in wetsuits because it was cold and a dreary day at the coast, which is typical. But I did to kind of end with the way we started.
Sure.
I got that same feeling from body surfing in off the coast of the Santa Monica Pier around there. What you learn is you're not the center of the universe.
Right.
Nature is more powerful than you, and you better adapt or you're going to die. Because there were several times where a wave would take me down.
Yeah.
And I don't know how long it took me to learn, but you don't force your way to the surface.
Right.
You wait till it kind of just comes right over you. You're down below. And then when it dissipates, that's when you get up.
Yeah.
And if you try any sooner, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. Same thing with riptides, which happen all the time to people swimming off the Oregon coast and, of course, the California coast. If you're caught in a riptide, there's no finding it.
Right.
What they teach you is to swim parallel to the shore where the tide is no longer a riptide, and then you could swim in.
Going against your instincts to fight your way to shore,
But it's not going against nature.
Right, exactly.
It's
patience.
Working with nature rather than against nature because you cannot win.
Right, you cannot win. It's so true. We need to be reminded of that. And,
I think surfers kind of catch that. I get that from your book.
Yeah. Oh, that means the world to me. I'm glad to hear that. We do. We're so small in the grand scheme of things, but our lives are meaningful, and community and family do mean something, you know.
And to be in the ocean at the mercy
of
forces more powerful than you could imagine.
Absolutely.
Just a typical wave.
Yeah, immortal.
Well, Amy, thanks so much for talking with us today, and thanks for letting us all experience a little sun and surf during this cold, wet Portland December.
Thank you, Ken.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, we'd just like to hear it all again. You can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Amy Mason Doan, author of the novel The California Dreamers from Graydon House. You can learn more about Amy, the new book, and all her work and events online at amymasondoan.com. Just a reminder that we're in the second week of our KBOO Fights Back end-of-year drive. Since we get about 80% of our funding from our members, listeners like you, we need your help to reach our goal of $75,000 by December 31st. You can support programs like this and independent media by becoming a member today, renewing your membership, or making a one-time contribution. Just go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, January 8th, 2026. My, the new year already. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
let's go surfing now. Everybody's learning how. Come on a safari with me.